Hi, and welcome to Real Trail Talk. I am Donovan D'Souza from The Long Ways Better.
And I'm Mark Pybus from The Life of Pi. Welcome to episode 92. First off, would like to apologize for the very long real-time gap between podcasts.
Yeah.
I think it's been June, so 5 months.
Might even have been before that, I think. But I think we came out in June because I went to the Northern Territory for 9 days in June. And then we were like, yeah, we'll record after that. And then it's just been one thing after another. So yeah, sorry.
So it's been like a combination of trips and illness and everything else. But we're back and we're probably going to do a few episodes before the year's out.
Yeah, so we've definitely been out and been doing a bit of our own adventuring, but we've also been having a few discussions about some overarching topics to discuss. So yeah, definitely got a few episodes in the pipeline.
That brings us on to the episode today, and we have a very special guest in Steve Surtis, one of our favorites for the podcast. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we have Steve in because of the Bibbulmun Track 25th anniversary walk that was run. I want to say it started in August.
No, that was about halfway through. It began in July. The actual walk, yeah. Okay. July 14 was kickoff date.
Yeah, because we had an idea at the start of the year. Like, we want to do like a few podcasts on the 25th anniversary, and we're kind of getting around to organizing it. And then all of a sudden, I see a picture of Steve at the start. I'm like, well,
I'm gone.
We've left it a bit too late. So we've got Steve in after the walk has ended to talk about the whole thing. So yeah, welcome, Stephen.
Fantastic. Good to be here, actually. And it's nice to kind of debrief, because I'm still in that phase of debriefing, which is good, even though it's, now November.
Yeah, so you've had, it was September when the walk finished in Albany, so you've had a few weeks to decompress. But I've got a few quick fire questions I want to start with.
Okay.
What's your favourite section? When's lunch? When's the debrief? And how many kilometres tomorrow are we walking?
Well, actually, let's start with the last one first. That wasn't actually one of the questions I was, that was thrown at me. It was slightly different. It was how long is tomorrow? And the answer was 24 hours. But as to the other questions, so these were questions that came up very often, almost every day, not quite every day. And I think we were into the walk about a week, and someone had written in our little diary that we carried the whole way, a fair few pages into the diary, so I didn't see it until much later, but said, "Questions to Ask Steve." That was the title. And what you just asked was pretty much all of them. Yeah, so the big one was like, we'd get to a break and people would say, "Is this lunch?" And it was mainly the sectional walkers that were asking, because all the other walkers, the core walkers who were going the whole way, coaxed them into saying that and winding me up. So, yeah, there's a lot of that going on.
We'll start with the serious questions. I guess kind of the concept and the planning of the 25th anniversary, because there was a 10th anniversary walk in 2008 that you were a part of. I guess kind of 25 is a significant number. Why not do it in the 10-year intervals?
That's a good question. So when we had done the 10th anniversary, the 20th actually started coming around pretty quick in terms of, starting to think about planning for it, because such a big event, it takes a little over 3 years to just get things happening and start thinking about it, having meetings and going, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to approach this? And so 7 years out from the 10th anniversary, when people were saying, let's do a 20th, I went, too soon. So that's why we ended up with the 25th, which also means, because, people say, oh, you're going to do a 30th. I'm going, no, do the math, 10, 25, 50.
So we'll have a retirement age Steve kind of hobbling about organising.
That's not the plan.
It'll be your final hurrah on the track.
Well, we'll see. But it does involve a lot of work. But having done the 10th anniversary, a lot of the the things were kind of, you know, in place. We didn't have to recreate the wheel. So the 25th was largely based on the 10th anniversary. There were some differences, but we learned a lot from the 10th anniversary just from a event planning perspective. So that was really good to have done that.
Mm-hmm. So when you say it takes 3 years to plan... Can you describe what that actually is? Because, you know, like that seems like a long time, but obviously it is necessary for something like this.
Yeah, I guess what you've also got to consider is that everything else goes on as well. So nothing else stops so you can do a celebration walk like this. You still do everything else that you do. So all the events that I normally run, they still pretty much happened. And so just the general daily business goes on. But to, do an event like that, because there's so many facets to it and so many moving parts as well, from a logistical point of view, just from a broadly event management point of view, you have to get those conversations started early on and flag it with a lot of people. For some people, it's too far out and they don't want to know. And so it's also managing, you know, who you start talking to and when. But we did, for the 25th anniversary, we started talking to our volunteer team. I had a team of a handful of volunteers that what I called the logistical volunteers, which were helping me just, you know, being a sounding board, if you like. I'm thinking, okay, here's a draft itinerary. What do you think? You know, we've got these restrictions. This is where we've got to be on these dates. And what do you reckon? Should we skip that campsite or not? And okay, great, that's our itinerary. Now, what about food drops and what about this and what about that? So, and once you've got those plans in place, then you actually start need to doing the work, you know, to go from there. So, yeah, it's a lot of planning. There's a lot of talking and a lot of bringing people on board with it too. And that takes time as well. So, but it's all part of the fun. You know, it's like I say to anyone planning to do an end-to-end. You know, planning is part of the journey. So, you know, it's good fun.
Almost half the fun. So in terms of, like you mentioned, getting people together, obviously there'd be quite a few people wanting to go on this end-to-end walk. How did the selection criteria go for selecting people, and what was the limit of the people?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that had to start very early, because for people to get time off from work or life or whatever it is they do, to have that full 2 months off, you know, they need a lot of time to plan that, but also get their gear sorted, get training and, you know, all the rest of it. So the applications to be a core walker, and there were only 10 places available for that, applications for that, now I might get my dates mixed up a little bit here, but I'm pretty sure they opened in January 2022. So that's more than a year before. But the applications were open for a long time. They were open right through to about August 22. So people had plenty of time to think about it. But we wanted to give people the best opportunity to, you know, consider that. And then once we got all the applications in, I think the applications closed mid-August or so. Then we had a selection process among all those applications. We had some people pull out before they even went any further. So beyond the application process for various reasons. But there were a screening process, if you like. So we looked at what experience people had walking, you know, what other trails they might have done, what their general life is like, just a whole lot of questions, you know, that kind of thing. And so we didn't want to exclude people from beyond Perth, because we did have a screening walk, and we encouraged people to come along onto that one before they were actually selected to do the end-to-end, just to see how they go. I picked a reasonably tough section. We walked from the Hills Forest to Woolwich, and back, not in one day. We did it as an overnighter. So we wanted to see how they went with a full pack, and even though it was just one night, just to, you know, give them a bit of an idea of what they're in for as well. So we had the screening walk as well, which became a bit of a talking point on the anniversary walk. I'll come to that later. And, pardon me. You've got to remember that this was, you know, not quite a year before the walk started. It was almost a year out. So, you know, people were just getting to know each other. But of course, there were people, as I said, people that couldn't make the screening walk, and they weren't excluded because of that, but there was an extra kind of process behind that. So once we had people that had gone past that first screening process, if you like. We ended up with 26 or 27, my memory is a bit shot on that, but it's around that, applications that went into a ballot. So they went into the draw for the 10 places. And I stood back at arm's length from that. I made a point of telling everyone I'm not involved in the ballot because I knew people that were going into the ballot. And so, I needed to distance myself from that. And so our volunteers in the office actually drew the people out of a hat, out of a box or whatever they used. And the 10 people were selected. But we ended up, what we did do was we drew everyone out. So we went right through to number 26 or 27. So if one person couldn't do it, declined, it would move on to the next person in the order. So we didn't have to do another draw. So that's how the process was. And then I had the fun of telling people that they were successful. But also on the same side, disappointing people because they, you know, missed out and they were really, really keen to join in. So the people that missed out were given, if they wanted it, first dibs at any of the sections before they were open to the public to book onto, because we weren't quite sure what the demand was going to be on that. So we thought, well, we'll give you first choice. And I recall one of the core walkers toward the end of the hike. So we're on the south coast somewhere. And he said to the group, he said, you know, I only really wanted to do a sectional walk, but I put my name in as a core walker because I wanted to get a sectional. And then I got in and I just went, oh, shit. It is so him. That was Joe. he never told anyone that till the whole thing was almost over. But that was pretty cool. So, yeah, and then the ensuing months after that, we had a number of online briefings because we had person from Esperance, person from Kalgoorlie, a person from Orange in New South Wales, and then the rest of us dotted around the Perth metro area, really. And so we had a few briefings there, lots of catch-ups online, and just making sure everyone was planning. And people, if you ask them, I think one of the things that they would remember from that is me telling them, time is running out, get planning, get yourself sorted, get your training happening, get your food happening, because before you know it, we're going to be sitting at Kalamunda ready to start walking.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the Perth Hills to Wallach as a training hike, because I took my dad there in August as a training hike for the Cape to Cape, and I forgot how tough that section is. And I think, like, I asked him, did you enjoy it? And his answer was non-committal.
Yeah.
I love you, son, but.
Yeah, that's right. What have you done?
Yeah. So it sounds like it was a very thorough screening process. My only question is, how did Annie get through? What was she like on that that sound out hike?
So Annie wasn't on the screening walk, but she had done or was doing before the ballot one of our other walks, which was actually a three-day walk in the same area. She was doing Mundaring to Brookton Highway or Dale Road or something. I thought, well, if she's doing that, I'm going to get lots of feedback from my guides about Annie because I wasn't on that walk. But yeah, that's how she got in.
A joke, of course. Annie, very nice lady. She put me up in Esperance while I was staying there. And best described as one of the characters of the walk.
Yeah, and we knew that very early on. I mean, I knew it pretty early on because I met Annie well before it, and before most others met Annie. But we, one of the Zoom meetings we had, Annie was no less than 10 seconds behind. There was like a delay on the Zoom. And so... it got to the end of the Zoom meeting that we had, and he was just sitting there. I said to everyone, all right, guys, you can all go now. I'm just going to sit here and wait for Annie because she's going to realize that we're all gone. And she's going, hello, hello, is anyone there? I'm leaving. I think you've all gone. Bye. So that just set the scene for the whole walk, really. Yeah.
All right, so we've done 3 years of planning. Mm. Everyone's been selected. Mm. It comes time to start the walk in Kalamunda. How great a moment was that when everyone lined up with their walking poles in the air and Steve gets coronated as King of the Billman Track to start the walk?
Do you know, that was a pretty full-on day. Ask any of the walkers. For different reasons, it was very full-on for them. Some people were really overwhelmed with the people, the noise. We had drummers there. You know, it was a very, very hyped-up event. It was fabulous. It was just amazing. I was described as by a sectional walker who was doing media that morning from, she was from DBCA, and she did a sectional walk around Mount Cook. And she said to me, I said, so what do you reckon? How did I do that interview? And, you know, we had a bit of a chat, and she, in front of everyone around the campfire, she said, Steve, you were off your chops. I don't think I've ever been told that before. But look, really emotional. It was just fantastic to have so many people there, so many bright, smiling faces, and so many people joining. I remember a few things about that morning, but I remember on one section of the track, I turned around and looked, because I was up the front, and it was just this long train of people, and I couldn't see the end of them. There was just so many people, you know, guiding us or walking us out, if you like. So it was just, it really set the tone. And I said it a lot of times on our journey. I said, the support that the Bilman track has is just amazing, and we really see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just really brought it to the fore. It was amazing.
So with the, you know, the core group plus the section hikers, plus there'd be like other, I guess other people.
Yeah.
How many people were walking at once? Yeah.
Okay, so I'll break it down a little bit. So like I said, we had 10 core walkers do the whole journey.
Is that including you, or
no,
you're on top
that's
of...
plus me, yeah.
And is there anyone else on top of you? Or... Yeah.
Not on top of me, no. I'll just nip that in the bud. So I was the guide the whole way, but I had, like the sectional walkers, I had a co-guide, that would, a volunteer guide that would join us for the sections as well. So they swapped and changed as well. Because part of what I wanted to achieve for this walk was also involve as many volunteers as possible and volunteer guides in that respect too. So we had an extra guide along with me, and then we had... the sectional walkers varied. Most of the time we had anywhere between 3 and 6 sectional walkers join. On some occasions we had 7 and 8, so it made it a reasonably big group. Mm. But we seemed to manage that very well, and I will say that the core walkers were very inclusive of all the walkers that joined. So that was, the dynamic was really good, so kudos to them. But then, as you say, there were others as well. So we had people join us in the towns along the way. So in the days that, on the sections walking into a town, we would have locals join us. We had free buses as part of a grant that we got as well from DLGSC to bring people out to meet us and then walk back into town. And then we had schools as well. It didn't happen at every single event, and it did happen at, you know, various levels, I guess. I remember in bailing up, we had the medieval king guide us around town. So we actually walked past where we were having the celebration, did a complete lap circuit of the town, and then picked up the primary school kids and then came back down the highway. And we just put the Bilman track flags, the teardrop banners that we've got, like boom gates across the Southwest Highway. Don't tell the police this, or traffic management. We put them down to get the kids across because there were so many kids and so many people crossing the highway. So we just had to stop the traffic to get them across safely. But I just remember, again, looking back and just seeing so many people. So it varied a bit. But, yeah, we had a lot of support and a lot of people join us along the way. I'm doing the sum still about how many people joined us in each of the towns, but it was a lot in some of the towns. Yeah.
So you say you got a lot of support along the trail. It's also people meeting you out on the trail as well. Like the volunteers come out to their section.
Like someone from the Kingdom of Pi?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Although I was upstaged by a few people the day before who did a barbecue.
Yeah. So we had a lot of, let's call them trail angels because that's what they were. We had people meet us out on the track with all sorts of little goodies. It became a little bit comical, even within the first few days, because people would say, oh, we'll meet you at Fern Road with a sausage sizzle. And we're going, Fern Road, we haven't even started yet. We've just left Kalamunda already. It didn't happen. So, you know, it kind of worked all right. We ended up spending about 2 hours at the Trails Hub Cafe. Michelle was giving us scones because we were end-to-enders. I'm going, we're not end-to-enders yet. But anyway, okay, fine, I'm not going to argue. So we had a, luckily we're only going as far as Hewitt's Hill the first day, right? Mm. So that was a good thing. But we had a lot of people, particularly in the northern half, pop up. And I just remember getting to a spot and there'd be a pop-up cafe, like seriously with fresh coffee. And I'm not talking instant coffee and chairs and a hoochie and, you know, a charging station for everyone's phones and fruit and all sorts of food and stuff. So yes, but that day that you're referring to, Mark, we had at Harvey Quinn Downing Road, we had three different sets of trail angels descend on Harvey Quinn Downing Road. So we had a food drop there. So we had Jim Freeman and his son do that side of it. We had one of the walkers, Stuart Carter, his family and neighbours put on this spread, which was insane. So we had one of the best soups I've ever had. But hot food, the soup as well. They did a barbecue. They had a table, a trestle table, which started off with things like bread rolls for a sausage sizzle to salad to biscuits to chocolate. And it just kept going down the table. And right at the end of the table was Nurofen and Panadol. It was just a smorgasbord of everything you needed. And then on top of that, we had Scott from Paddy Palin do a Trail Angel thing there as well. So he had his marquee and chairs and all sorts of stuff. And he had a whole lot of goods and, you know, so that was very yummy as well. And we were very full. And then we had to go up the hill, which I knew that was going to happen. But, you know, what are you going to do with all this food on offer? And we had to go up the hill, you know, past the conveyor belt as you head up that steep hill. And then down, you know, the other side down towards Possum Springs. And we get to Possum Springs and there's a box on the table from the volunteers that look after that campsite with loaves of bread, avocados, fruit and marshmallows and this and that. And the list just went on, which we tried to eat as much as possible because then we had to carry out the next day. And then we came across Mark.
So it's actually kind of fortunate because we got our wires crossed over dates. And I thought you were at Yordamung the night before when you're in Possum Springs. Mm. So I parked up on Asquith Road and I'm waiting there. And I've got everything set up on the table. I'm like, they'd be here by now, surely.
Yeah, something's happened.
So I walked into Yordamung and there was two guys there. And they're like, oh, by the way, the water tanks are both empty. So I was like, oh, that's not good. So I was phoning DVCA saying, you probably better get someone out here to check this out. So when I finally met you, it was a very fortunate circumstance.
Well, yeah, in that sense, we ended up, when we arrived at Yordamung, DVCA were there with their water tank, filling up the water tank, which was good. So that was, great to get on top of that. Really good. So good to have that heads up. But, sorry about that. I think it was very late at night that I was replying to your text about where we'd be on what day. But, you know, what it's like out on the track. Yeah, you forget what day's which.
It's a good excuse to walk, because I haven't been to Yordamung since I walked it on my section to section.
Right.
But I'll let you tell the reason why the tanks were empty, because there's a bit of a funny story there.
Yeah, I actually still question it. So when we arrived at the campsite, the guys there from DBCA said you might want to read the red register because it explains why the tanks are empty. One water tank was already quite low, and the other tank, which had quite a lot of water in it, was emptied because someone had tipped boiling water at about 3 a.m. in the morning when they couldn't sleep. We were making a cup of tea. Spilt boiling water, and apparently a lot of it, down through the table between their legs. And so they ended up parking themselves under the tap, if you can visualize what I'm saying.
Yep.
And with the tap on. And, yeah. And just running the water. But that's what the explanation was there. A lot of us, the first thing most of us said was, there's phone reception here. Wouldn't you just go 000? Anyway, don't know. We weren't there. So, but there you go. Yeah. We had water.
I think if you know when things like this happen on the track, you kind of just don't want to stop hiking, yeah. And you know you kind of want to just deal with it, and that might be the thought process there where you're just like, I'm gonna just keep going, it's gonna be fine.
Can you imagine walking into Collie though? With oh Lord,
you'd be walking very funny. Be a cowboy walk, I would say. So do you have any like we'll go through like any highlights that you had, any other funny stories from the walk? I'm sure you've got heaps and heaps and heaps of them.
Look, there were quite a few. So we had, I guess, having done the 10th anniversary but also leading a lot of groups out on the track, I'm very conscious that some people just need their space and a bit of me time, and I'm like that too. Even when I'm leading groups multi-day, I'll say, right, for the next hour, I'm just going to drop down the back and, you know, but I encourage you all to just have some me time and just some quiet and take it in and, you know, because that's something else I stressed along the way. You know, it was like, this is going to be over. It's going to go really fast and you're going to get to the end and go, what happened? And so savor the moment, you know, the whole thing about the destination not being important. And so I was very careful to raise that often and make sure everyone had their space. And, you know, because we had a lot of excited people on the trip, we had a lot of people that wanted to share everything, sometimes too much. And I remember lying in my tent. I was already awake at about 4:30 in the morning, and I thought, okay, there's phone reception here, so I'll get some emails and stuff done, so without getting up and what have you. And I could hear certain people already up and talking to each other. This was at Nogger Up campsite, and I had my tent set up on the eastern side of the creek, opposite, away from the shelter, and other people were camped on the other side there, opposite me, over the other side of the creek. And the fire had been through there not that long ago, so noise travels a little bit more. Anyway, so I'd been putting a WhatsApp text together, organising people for what they needed to expect at the next town and what was happening. So I thought I'll put all this together, talk about, you know, where their accommodation is and have that all there, where the laundromat is. And you know, it was really handy doing that WhatsApp because it means I didn't get the same question 10 times over. And so that was good. So I'm typing away and I flick off the first text. And then I hear Annie on the other side of the creek at 4:45 in the morning reading my text out at full volume to two other people while everyone else is asleep. So I then texted, Annie, I don't need you to read back my text. And so then she started laughing. And of course I heard that too. And she woke up most of the other people. But there you go. But that was also one of the other reasons I remember that morning is because that was the morning we had a little earthquake.
Oh.
Yeah. The start of August, around that time. Yeah, and it was felt quite widely. And we didn't really notice much, well, didn't take notice, but the tent was creaking and I didn't know why. So I was like, what's wrong with this tent? You know, there's no wind.
There's no one on top of me.
Yeah. What's going on? Yeah. So, but yeah, look, you're right. There are a lot of stories and I could be here all night telling them. But that was just one of the things. But there was always something happening. I do remember Joe walking around Lake Maringup, scratching his head, going, where are my boots? I can't find my boots. And he was always misplacing things because he was typically the person who, when he got to a campsite, everything went everywhere. Even though he had a tent, he put everything in one corner, well, one thing in one corner of the shelter, one thing over there, something out near the fire, something on the outside table. And then the next morning, he'd spend just now walking around collecting everything. And so he thought he'd picked everything up or found everything, but he couldn't find his boots. And he's, you know, we're just thinking, oh, here's Joe again looking for stuff. You know, we just rolled our eyes and just kept on doing what we're doing. 20 minutes later, he's still looking for his boots. And we're thinking, okay, this is not right. By now, he should have found them. And he's looking around. And because it was still about that time where the sun wasn't, you know, getting too high in the sky too early. So it was still pretty dark in the mornings when we were starting to pack up. And then I said, are these yours? And there was some boots there. And he goes, no, they're not mine. And it was like, well, whose are these boots? Because everyone else except you have got boots. And then we worked out that Karen had put on Joe's boots and couldn't work out why they were loose. And so she's been walking around because she put them on in the dark, and they look kind of the same, but a completely different size. Mm. So yeah, that was pretty funny. Lots of little instances like that.
Was Joe the one you had the tub licking competition with?
We call it the tongue off. Yeah. So coming back to what we said about having a number of trail angels, Tim Larkin, who is one of our board members, but also owns one of the properties along the Blackwood River, he came up to Blackwood campsite, and like other people, he came up on the wrong day, except that wasn't my fault. He for some reason, he didn't think we were having a rest day in bailing up, and he came up the day before. So he made the trip twice. But we were late getting into Blackwood campsite, leaving bailing up. And so he couldn't wait, but one of the walkers had already got in and just left some little goodies there, dips and crackers and what have you. And the plan was to, you know, for us to finish him. Then the next day, as we walk past his property, just leave the rubbish there for him. And so, you know, of course, like seagulls down at the beach with someone having fish and chips, we polished off everything pretty quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we'd just come from a town. we had these little tubs of dip. And, of course, there's just those little bits that you couldn't get out because it wasn't round. It was one of those hexagonal or octagonal containers. And so by that stage, I had the reputation of doing my washing up by licking out my bowls. So Joe decided to lick out one of the hummus tubs and thought he was going to do a really good job and compete with me. And everyone else was going, that's terrible, Joe. No. That's not how you do it. Ask Steve how to do it. And so there was another tub of other dip there. So we had a tongue off.
Yep.
So I licked out mine. He licked out his and we had a race. And, of course, I won.
Yep.
But that was good fun. There was a lot of it was filmed, which was hilarious to watch. But yeah, exciting stuff, you know.
Yeah, the things you get up to when you're on the trail.
I hadn't even got halfway there. But what, if you're talking about highlights, one of the big highlights for me was Donnelly River.
I was just about to ask you about that, because while I was out there, everyone was asking, are you going to be at Donnelly River? And I had no idea there was a big party planned for the halfway.
How could you not know?
I just didn't. Like, I'd seen all the sectional things you could sign up for. But, so it sounds like it was the whole weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And when I was talking about developing the itinerary, one of the restrictions we had was that our arrival in Donnelly River had to be on a Friday. And so we arrived on a Friday afternoon. The party was a Saturday night, and then we'd walk out on the Sunday. So it had to be a weekend. And again, that was similar to what we did on the 10th anniversary. But that was a highlight for me because Donnelly River was different to the other towns, where we had community celebrations in the other towns to thank the towns for the support over the last 25 years. The party at Donnelly River was a party for us, for the walkers, for the members, for the foundation and the Boomerang Track community. So it just went off. We had a band by the name of Do Not Resuscitate. And I actually caught up with one of the band members last week, Peter. He still couldn't get over how into it everybody was. And they were thinking, you know, they'd finish up at about 8 o'clock or, you know, 8:30 because they started at 5. Yeah. And 9 o'clock, I think they were still going. 9:30, they pushed it too because everyone was just having so much fun and they were just getting all this energy back from the crowd. But we had a huge number of people there to help celebrate not just the fact that the walkers had come through, but, you know, the whole 25 years. That's what it was all about too. Yeah. So it was just fantastic to see that community there.
So I'm picturing this party as like Bilbo Baggins' 71st birthday, like that kind of grandeur and spirit. Did you have like the whole amount of the cottages booked out and everything as well?
Yeah, most of the cottages were booked out. I don't think there were any spares. I know there were a couple of people that had booked what was left. They didn't know what was happening in the village. and what also happened was, well, it was really funny because, you know, it was the thing. We had a rest day there on the Saturday, and rest days for me were not rest days. There was a lot of work I had to do. But I was walking down towards the general store past, you know, that building that's called the TV room?
Yeah.
Okay. This weekend, the Matildas were playing. And people were, it was packed. Everyone was jam-packed into that room to watch the game. And those that couldn't fit in had got a couch and put it on the veranda to look through the window to watch the TV. And I took a photo of it because it was almost like the caption was, TV comes to Donald River Village, 1952. You know, something like that, because people were peering through the windows. So we had a few things going on that weekend, but I was just... it was electric. The atmosphere was electric. It was just so good to see so many people. And people walked out with us the next day as well. Fabulous.
So in terms of the planning, one question is, why could you not plan the weather a little bit better when you were coming into town every single time?
Gosh. We knew a town day was coming because the weather forecast was for rain. Most of the time. I mean, it's not that it didn't rain when we were out on the track. It did. I remember, in fact, at Donnelly River, at that point, I got up and I said, we've only had 6 days of rain this whole 4 weeks. And that was the case. You know, there was hardly any. Of course, there was more to come. But, you know, Collie was probably the worst walk into town day in terms of weather being shocking. It wasn't too bad as we were arriving in, but it let loose. But I don't know what it was, but not every town. Bailing Up, it didn't rain. I remember, I think there was another town that didn't rain. But yeah, it just, town days became synonymous with rain days. Go figure. I don't know. Even Albany, you know. We almost beat the Albany weather, but one of the buses coming out with a group of people to walk us took a lot longer than what we thought it would. And so we were sitting around for about half an hour. If we didn't have that wait, we would have made it in without getting wet at all. So I felt very sorry for the bagpipers who led us through the streets of Albany up to the town hall, and it was pouring with rain. The primary school kids who, you know, didn't blink. They, you know, one school did cancel, but the other two schools came along. And yeah, these primary school kids met us out near the wool stores there and walked all the way in from there. And yeah, it was coming down. Nut that weren't phased. It was great. Well,
I guess it's Albany, like they're used to it down there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't make a great, from seeing the stories, like I'm sure everyone was very happy, but like coming into Collie and some of the other ones where people are like, it's dark and they all kind of look a little bit miserable.
Yeah.
Wasn't a great advertisement for the track, but at least Albany, well, like, everyone's happy to finish. And
there is that. But I mean, you know, you're out there for 60 days, you're going to get some bad weather. You can't avoid it. But you're also, on top of that, people, and this was part of the discussion we had with the core group in the briefings, you know, people were going to have good days and people were going to have bad days. You just have that. Over that period of time, there are days where you just don't want to talk to anyone. You just want to be on your own. It might feel like a bit of a trudge or whatever it is. It comes up differently for different people. I hit a wall after Denmark, which was bizarre because, you know, you're on the home stretch. And a couple of days after Denmark, I was like, this is hard work. What's going on? Like, I just didn't have the energy. It was like, I mean, I got through it. And I don't think anyone even knew. People are going, what are you talking about? But that happens, and it happened for people from time to time, and that's, you know, normal. You should expect that, especially over 60 days.
We mentioned Annie a few times, but she actually injured her ankle with about, was it 400 kilometers to go, and decided I'm just gonna soldier on.
So we had a few injuries. Annie was one. So her ankle started playing up around, I think it was just south of Collie somewhere. And so that was difficult for her. She had to, there was a lot of, you know, psychological determination, I guess, that she applied. But she had the personality for it. She had some tough days, but she got through it. And you know, she acknowledged as well that, you know, we're all there to support her, and we were. And that was the brilliant thing about the whole group, not just the core group. Everyone on each section were a family, and they supported each other. So it was brilliant. We had Tracy, who injured her knee. Must have been that earthquake that did it at Noggera, because that's where she injured her knee that morning. And she had to skip a section, but then she rejoined us at Donnelly River Village, and that was tough for her. But she had determination as well, and she did it. And then, of course, she went back and completed it before she went back home. So, you know, she did the whole lot as well. So kudos to her as well. And Sue, of course, she probably missed most of it because she had really bad, I think it was ankle as well. Now I'm getting confused now. Was it ankle and knee? Sue, tell me. Text through, Sue, and tell me if it was your ankle.
Was Sue the one that was ahead of you guys when I came out?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
That was maybe knee or ankle. Yeah, I can't remember.
I think it might have been knee now. But in any case, Sue struggled as well, but she did really well. She did join us again, which was fabulous. The group did miss her because, you know, we bonded. And so if anyone, something happened to anyone, you know, we were there for each other. And, yeah, it's you get very emotional. Not just when you finish an end-to-end, but when you finish an end-to-end of something of this magnitude and you've bonded with so many people. It was pretty tough for me when I got into Albany from that point of view too.
Can I ask, how many through hike end-to-ends have you done now?
It must be four.
Four?
Yeah, yeah. So because I've done nine all up. Yeah, so it's four and five sectionals.
And how does this one compare with the 10th anniversary?
It's very different in a few ways. Of course, the big difference was the 10th anniversary, we went south to north.
Okay.
So it was actually tougher because we hit the beaches first up. So I remember that being really tough, but the weather was a lot worse on the 10th anniversary too. We had a storm at Rame Head on this walk, but we had a cyclone at West Cape Howe on the 10th anniversary. It felt like it anyway. We had a lot of tents come down, and Rame Head almost matched it, but not quite on the 25th anniversary. But we had bad weather and things happen until we got to Northcliffe. But once we hit Northcliffe on the 10th anniversary, we didn't get a dot of rain all the way to Kalamunda, which was insane.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tough. We had the tree that came down on Giants.
Oh,
the Tingle Tree. Wow. Yep. The day we were walking to the campsite, I got a phone call going, "You can't stay there tonight." I was like, "What are you talking about? This is an official walk. What do you mean?" Yep, there's a tree on it. So lots of little things like that happened along the way. So I actually found that the 10th anniversary more challenging from a logistical point of view.
Mm.
There weren't many things that went wrong on the 25th anniversary. There were little things like walking into Dwelling Up and getting a phone call going from the Dwelling Up pub saying, "Sorry guys, we have to cancel your dinner tonight because we don't have the staff." It's like, what? We're on day, what was it, 14? I don't know what day we were on, 12 or whatever it was. And I was like, this is our first meal, you know. It's like, you cannot not feed us. You know? So, and he comes to the rescue, who's, I think it was her brother worked there. It was the chef, and says, "What do you mean you're not going to feed us?" We ended up having dinner at the Dwelling Up pub. It was all good. But there were other little things, but nothing insurmountable, really. Yeah. So everything went really smoothly. And that's largely thanks to not just the planning that everybody did, but the support we had along the way from the volunteers that I mentioned earlier, the logistical volunteers. There were a lot of support we had from them, from people in the towns as well, trail angels that I'd ring up and go, "Hey, can you sort something? Something's happened. Can you do this?" And anyone would, if any call for help, they were there. It was just, sensational to have that support.
Between the two, because you did the 10 and 25, obviously two things I think that would be different is that obviously the track changes in that time, but also the people changes. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I always find that really, that, you know, the intrinsic elements and the extrinsic elements to the trail are always actually, you know, they're not really that intrinsic.
Yeah. I mean, just have a look at the demographics and you'll see a difference between the 10th and the 25th in terms of even just the core walkers. We only had two females on the 10th anniversary, whereas on the 25th anniversary, most of the walkers were female. So instantly you see a change there, and I guess that was also apparent with the sectional walkers. We had a different cohort of people for sectional walkers. That I guess between in that intervening 15 years you had a whole lot of new people that were introduced to the track, and this was their first real opportunity to get involved in something big, and even do a long sectional walk. So you had that. Whereas for the 10th anniversary, I had the feeling that most people were much more experienced and had done something like that before. Also, the people in the towns as well, there was a whole lot of new people that I got to meet and, you know, that I might have spoken to over the phone. But interestingly enough, there were some people I hadn't even met who had been involved as long as I have, like the late 90s. And I met a couple of people. It's like, I've only ever heard your name or I've only ever spoken to you on the phone and never met them face to face. So that was really good. In terms of the track changing, obviously, the track is constantly being realigned. So there's those physical changes, I guess.
15 years ago, was Blackwood the old Blackwood?
Yeah, it was.
Hmm.
Yeah. Was it? Yes, it was. It was before the fire. Yeah, that's right. So things like that, absolutely. And you remember what campsites used to be like before fires. So like Possum Springs or Berriking or whichever campsite it was.
Of course.
Yeah, well, that's right, Dogpool. So we didn't have any rammed earth campsites when we did the 10th anniversary. We didn't have campsites that had the extensions, so we had the smaller star shelters. Mm. So a lot of work in that sense, but also in terms of erosion control and things like that and where the track goes. As I said, that's changed as well. I noticed, for example, some sections, more culverts and less bridges. Mm. You know, so a change in the way the track is managed, in a sense.
Yeah.
More water tanks, extra tables or more tent sites or, you know, just little things like that. Also, I notice more the visibility of the sectional volunteers, the maintenance volunteers that look after the track. For example, there's signs there, not just for us, there are more permanent signs saying, welcome to section, da 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 da, we look after this. Or there's something in the shelter about, I'm the maintenance volunteer, and there's a little bio, you know. So things like that were different as well. I guess for me, though, see, if I had only done the 10th anniversary and then not done anything in 15 years and come back and did the 25th, I probably would have noticed a lot more. But for me, I see those changes over time. So, you know, they're not as stark for me. You know, I can point some of that, but you might want to talk to some other people and they'll say, yeah, this is how it was different and how it's changed over the years. Of course, technology's changed too. So we had people using apps, whereas back then, they went around for navigation. So those sorts of things. And the communications along the track too. I remember on the 10th anniversary, I had a sat phone with me because there was just not enough comms. This time I didn't need a sat phone. I had other communication devices. But most of the time I just used my regular phone.
Mm.
Yeah.
So on that, do you find having access to, you know, WhatsApp and being able to be in constant communication with everyone, do you enjoy that or do you miss the times when you would go out on a section and you'd have reception once a day or once every 2 days?
Yeah, really good question. And for the 25th anniversary, because it was a logistically heavy event, logistically intense event, I needed that technology. If we were just walking, say, from town to town, and that was the walk, then, yeah, I long for the days where Bailing Up never had a phone tower. You know, I remember that. It wasn't actually that long ago. So you know that when you went to Blackwood campsite, that you wouldn't get reception there, right? And it was like, this is a weekend free from anything, you know, like that. So you were forced to, you know, interact with people, you know, face to face. But, you know, there are times where you do need it. And it came in very handy. Like you said, having that WhatsApp group to communicate with everyone made my life easier. However, I've got to also recognize that having access to emails more often made my life busier. But I needed to get on to those kind of things. If I didn't do it as I went along, it'd mean it'd be all built up and waiting for me when I got to a town. And then, yeah, there would be a lot more work. So, you know, from an event management point of view, it was good having those comms.
I guess we'll talk about the finish. You've already kind of touched on it. Yeah. It was a very emotional event. Like, having not done an end-to-end, I can kind of imagine what it'd be like, but also, like, I wouldn't be able to touch on the emotions of coming off a track, especially your 25th anniversary walk, where you've spent it with all these new people, all these volunteers. Was it a tough come down, like more than usual?
Yeah. So on our first night at Hewitt's Hill, when we rocked up there and all the others had peeled off, you know, all those people that had joined us from Kalamunda and got to Hewitt's and it was just us. I was like, here we are, guys. This is it. You know, we're here now. This is the reality of it. And so people were just settling in. There were three other people at the campsite. There were a couple that had done a section and they were finishing off a sectional end to end, heading towards Kalamunda. And there was one guy there who'd come from Albany. So that was his last night. And I said to everyone, I said, see that? That's going to be you in 60 days, or 59 days, whatever it was. And people said to him, how are you feeling? He says, I'm feeling a lot. I'm paraphrasing what he said, but he said, I'm feeling a lot, but I'm not going to tell you because you need to experience it yourself. And it's going to be different for all of you. And so as we were approaching Albany, I did hark back to his comments. And, you know, some of the others brought it up as well. And, you know, I actually said to people, look, on our last night at Sand Patch Campsite, we're going to have other people join us because it's our last night. They're going to come in. They're not staying, but they're going to come in and congratulate us that we've made it this far and we'll see them again in Albany. But we'll have a bit of a shindig, which we did have, which was great. We had a lot of people at Sand Patch that afternoon, but we actually had a bit of a chat at Mutton Bird. You know, the second last night, well, it was just us. And just preparing people for it, we did just have a meeting. The only meeting we had on the track with just the core group was in Denmark, because every other time we either had sectionals with us or other people. So we made some time in Denmark just to have a bit of a chat. And I purposely wanted to do that to check in with everybody and say to them, look, we're getting there now. I want you to just stay in check with your emotions, because things will, you know, will flood over you. Sometimes it'll be hard to cope with. If you want to talk, we're all here. If you don't want to talk, you just want space, that's fine too. But there's going to be a range of emotions that you're going to start feeling as we start ticking off the last of the milestones, coming over that little ridge at West Cape Howe where you see the wind farm and you think, okay, this is it. Mm-hmm. Coming around to the last of the campsites, you know, and of course Sand Patch, and then of course walking into Albany as well. And so it was a very emotional final night at Sand Patch, but of course walking into Albany, a few of us were interviewed, and we've got a copy of that interview, those interviews, and you can really see it, including me, on their faces and in their voice as they spoke about how they were feeling. And I recall that I just couldn't describe how many emotions I was feeling and what they were. There were so many. I shed tears walking up York Street. I was so proud of the group. I was so honoured to have led the walk as well. So different from a regular end-to-end, absolutely. I've always said to people when I do our end-to-end workshops, and even to this group, I said, look, it's really important when you finish off something such magnitude and something which gives you such a sense of achievement, that you have people meet you at the end, because it can be an anticlimax. And you need not just them to make a bit of a hoo-ha for you, but also give you the support you need if you need it. That's really important. So never, ever finish an end-to-end on your own, ever.
like when Mark and Alyssa were not there for me when I finished the Mundabini.
No!
I was actually thinking more, if Karis was listening, that she just didn't elect to come down when I finished the Mundabini. But that's all right. I had some alone time to myself.
Yeah. Look, it is I know where you're coming from. I've done sectional walks too, and it's like, it doesn't have the same feel. It does still, because you think, well, I've done every step of the way, and you know, I'm an end-to-ender now. So from that aspect, I guess it does. But yeah, it is different. Mm. And look, all you got to do is walk out to Hewitt's Hill or to Sand Patch Campsite and read the books. You know, people having their last nights, or even the other campsites around that area, depending where they're spending their last night. Just read what people write. It's an outpouring of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And the range of them is astounding. But it's an amazing feeling. And I know, one of the things I also talked about was getting back into society. I had a chat to people. I'm going, look, here's what I experienced when I did my first through end-to-end. I had a lot of trouble dealing with society, noise, people, pollution, traveling in a car more than 4Ks an hour. things that you don't expect to impact you. Chlorine in the water. Just a huge range of things that can impact on you when you least expect it. And it was really good having that WhatsApp group after the walk as well, because we were still touching base and people were touching base with each other outside that group, but we knew we had each other if we needed to chat, or because we knew how we were feeling and we could relate. So that was important, and we still have it.
So you've just had the members night for the Buildman track that was kind of mainly focused on the 25th anniversary walk. How was that, seeing everything in like a montage of photos and having everyone there to celebrate? Was that kind of like a final like hurrah of, yeah, we did it, and a nice celebration?
That's not how I saw it. I saw it as a re-immersion back into it all. I guess I'd gotten busy with, you know, tying up the loose ends of the event and, you know, progressing other things in terms of a work perspective. I'd packed up my, you know, most of the gear and, you know, so there was already a finality to it before that. But it was good to revisit. It was good to hear Karen and Erica speak. Karen and Erica speak about their experiences as well. And their experiences, you know, a number of weeks after the end of the walk. So that was good, just to touch base and hear them share with others what they were feeling and how they got through that. I guess it was a bit of a nice kind of, a debrief, which was really good. But just to share what we felt and share it with people that had been involved but others who hadn't been involved was really good too.
One of the things that I really love about the bib is I feel like, you know, like there's that John Muir quote about nature's not like it's yet made, you know, like it's not finished. And I feel like the bib is always like never finished. It's always improving. It's always changing. You know, I've been involved in Facebook groups and you see the people who come and go, who are, you know, it's become like they're everything and then they leave and things like that. What's next for the bib? I guess both in terms of, is there a 30th?
No.
But also, I guess, you know, where to from here? 25 years? Where will the bib be in 25 years from now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because if someone asked me that 25 years ago, I'm not sure that I would have been able to give a full answer. I guess we've got, back then we would have had an idea of like, you know, it would be well known and lots of people would be walking it end to end. People would be coming from around the world, you know, saying that 25 years ago when it was just starting out, you have that. I think for me, it's a little difficult to say where it's going to be in 25 years. I can certainly put a few things out there. One of the things I'll say again, it's not going to Esperance. Never will.
Yes, I agree. Okay?
It never, ever, ever will. Anyway, so that, I can't believe that's still coming up. That has been coming up for 25 years. But seriously, though, I think that the track has got so much support. I find I very much doubt that would wane. I think the track will go from strength to strength because of that support, the volunteer support, the community support along the whole length of the trail. And I think while the foundation is there with that support behind it and the relationship with Parks and Wildlife, I think that'll go from strength to strength and keep pace, in the sense that, you know, keep up with whatever challenges it finds, whether it's erosion control, whether it's land tenure and mining, whether whatever it is, I think it will find a way to flourish despite those challenges because of that support. So while the last 25 years has been, you know, getting out there, getting established, and getting well known, etc. Now I think we're well and truly into a period of consolidation, but you can still have growth as well around that. So while we still want to keep the track simple and rustic, if you like, we still want to try and attract the broadest range of people. So I see there's areas of growth, like, you know, 15 years ago, we wouldn't have thought of trail running being a thing out on the bib. Mm. So, you know, there's probably other opportunities out there we haven't even thought of yet. So there's definitely opportunities for growth in that sense. So, yeah, in the next 25 years, I will be a volunteer probably going, this is how we did it in my day.
Colored chairs for every campsite.
Do you think, and like, I really enjoyed the new trail Leaving Helena. Mm-hmm. I think that's really great. Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll ever see a diversion away from Maribyrnong?
No, I was waiting for that one. Yeah, I don't know. Well, look, there is a drive, if you like, or a want to get the track off vehicle tracks as much as possible. But, you know, that's going to be a challenge because, you know, sometimes there's, you know, areas that are just inundated or there's rare flora or whatever it is. There's going to be a challenge. So there's always going to be some of that here and there as well. I guess the challenges going forward, you know, I mean, you know, everyone is different. Some people like those forest tracks because they can walk side by side and talk and what have you. And other people like the single trail. I think having a mix is good. I think that having it on things like rail formations or forestry tracks which are not used by vehicles, so it has a chance to grow in and form a track, I think that's really good. So, you know, if I can't see it happening really because of just the vegetation, I guess, but if Marin Road had vegetation grown in around it, for example, it wouldn't look like a road anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I mean? It feels so wide and so long that it just... Yeah, if as you say, like if it had been a narrower grown-in track, you wouldn't feel the...
even come off it for a kilometre and come back on it kind of thing, you know? Yeah. So just to break it up a bit. So, look, there's ways to deal with that sort of thing. I guess, you know, just dealing with different priorities is always going to be a challenge going forward. It has been, and that always will be there. But, you know, we're getting a lot of stuff done, which is just amazing. The support volunteers that we have getting so much work done, which is just brilliant. Mm. Yeah.
I think there's hope for you yet, Donovan, because if they've realigned or they're about to realign the area after the suspension bridge over the Murray River, Marin Road's possible.
Yeah.
It has to happen after the Kingdom of Pi.
That's right. Yeah. We were hoping that was going to happen before our walk, but there you go. But that's right. And the only thing I don't think will probably change is Burnt Jarrah.
You have to keep that in just for Donovan.
Yeah. If you can walk 10 seconds without seeing char marks, is it the Bevelman track?
Well, you know, got to have an ID. You know.
You've talked it up so much.
That's it.
But just on realignments, did you walk the Wilson Inlet realignment, or not realignment, but kind
the
of
the alternate route?
The alternate route.
Yeah, no, we didn't because the sandbar was breached, so the water was flowing. So we didn't do that. We actually got a bus around to the other side where the boat would have dropped you off, where the jetty is there, and we continued our walk from there. We did look at it as a possibility, but we knew that that time of year, you know, with the rains that they'd had, it wasn't going to happen. We knew that, you know, a little way out. So, and I think it's still, I don't think it's actually been, like, it was built and then the sandbar was breached almost within 2 weeks of it being built. So I don't think many people have had a chance to use it. As far as I know, that's still flowing. So, but, you know, there's another bit of the track I haven't walked. And of course, there's other bits of the track, you know, things like circuits being built as well that will provide new opportunities as well.
Going up to the top of conspicuous cliffs.
Yes, no, I can't say I've done that.
So I was out doing a walk from Conspicuous Beach up to Rame Head, and I remember doing my sectional end-to-end, going up to the top of the cliffs and looking down at the beach again, And I couldn't find the route. So I'm messaging Steve while I'm out there. It's like, when they did the erosion control stuff, did they eliminate that track? And Steve's like, what track?
If there was a track there, it's probably still there somewhere.
It was. I found it again, but I had to kind of go up some dodgy rock risk areas. Yeah.
Because the bit that was realigned was after Ramehead, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that's right. That used to be like a really cool wild section.
Yeah,
that's right.
That inland section as you approach Castle Rock from Ramehead campsite on your way to Peaceful Bay. Yeah, a lot more of that was on the beach. But yeah, that was realigned very early days though because of all the erosion and washaways and yeah.
Mm. I still remember there were like tires up sand dunes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And that's something that I always vividly remembered and you just don't see those anymore.
There's one set still there as you come down onto Quarren Beach after you go through the showgrounds, and I think that's about all.
Yeah.
I think the rest of all been removed or yeah that's right, that was that were used a fair amount. I remember that. But there you go, the you know, the Buddhists have a name for it, they call it a nicha, the, you know, the change over time, things just always changing.
And one of the last questions, Steve, as an avid like kind of wildflower and flora lover, did you see anything new on the 25th anniversary that you hadn't seen before?
New to me, yeah, I did. I'd never actually seen a rabbit orchid. Yeah, I was like, they're out there all the time, but I've never actually saw one. And we saw, we stopped on one of the rocky outcrops approaching Tor Bay campsite, and we just stopped there for lunch. I was like, what's that? It's a rabbit orchid. And of course, there's a swarm of us down on our knees taking photos of rabbit orchids. Fabulous. But yeah, there were a few things, but that one's definitely a standout. I do remember telling everyone that we're likely to see the king in his carriage orchid as we crossed Ficafolia Road on our way down to the coast there. And they all walked past it, and I was down the back, and I'm going, it's over here. It's come back, and they couldn't hear me, so they never saw it. But I had seen it before, but
not surprising, because those things are tiny.
They're tiny. They are. Yeah. They are small. But yeah, we saw lots of little things that I didn't know what they were, and we had to get them identified. Yeah.
So last time you were here,
yeah,
when we did the draft,
yeah,
you picked Wireless Hill. Was that one of the ones you picked?
It was, yes.
You picked Wireless Hill, and we were all like, what are you doing, Steve? Like, there's so many better trails, but I have to say...
Was it Wireless Hill?
Yeah, you picked Wireless Hill as your Perth trail.
Did I? Okay.
Maybe you're...
All right.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
I have to say, living now very close to Wireless Hill and going multiple times a week, I get it.
Yeah, if you hit it at the right time in the spring... the wildflowers there, particularly the orchids, are really cool. And if you get a really good season, you don't have to go very far to see them, do you? Like you say, they're right there. Different types of spiders and, so many different types as well of wildflowers. Granny's bonnets and, there's a plethora there, which is amazing. Mm. And sometimes I see orchids there sometimes that I don't see out on the bib. That often. So that's exciting. So little patches around Perth like that. There's a few of them, if you know where to go. Mm. I went hunting for the Queen of Sheba while I was down in Albany.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't see it. Saw stems. We just missed
them.
Some were still coming. They hadn't quite got there yet, but others had completely finished. So, it was worth a try to drive out there, and, a few of us went out there. Keep looking.
Well, thanks for coming in, Steve. You're a favourite guest of the pod, and we keep coming up with excuses to have you in. So good, if you do a 26th anniversary walk, would be mostly appreciated.
I'm not sure it's worth doing a 26th just to come on the pod. Sorry.
We'll have to come up with a new excuse, although we are neighbours now, so maybe I might see you a bit more in the future.
Fabulous. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode or any other episode of Real Trail Talk, then please rate us on whatever platform you're currently listening to us on. Ratings really help us to reach an audience, especially those who are looking to learn about the outdoors in Western Australia and Australia in general. If you had any questions or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at realtrailtalk@gmail.com or contact us through our social media channels. Thanks again, and stay tuned for our next episode.